Session number 7465.
Major Banner, tape 2. You mentioned the vast amount of wounded coming ashore. When you were actually on V Beach, did you see any evidence of dead people, dead troops?
I'm sorry. I got to the casualty clearing station, but they were mainly brought in, either brought in dead from the trenches, or they came, say, from the operating theatre, or examining tents and so on, for disposal, actually for burial in a big trench. No, in a big grave, rather.
They were buried in a mass grave, were they?
Yes, for the time. Later, of course, the War Graves Commission made proper cemeteries are there.
Were there any illnesses other than wounds? You know, did people start going down with dysentery or other complaints?
Not at that stage, because it was so new. We hadn't got settled down. Later on, though, because of the shortage of fresh water, for example, Dixies had to be cleaned with sand instead of water. Well, that, of course, led to troubles. That was mainly on Lemnos, though, when I got that, being only on the peninsula for about 3 days.
Is there anything else you can tell us of what you saw when you were on the peninsula that you might think of interest? You know, any outstanding memories or impressions?
Well, yes. For the 3 days I was on the peninsula, I was mainly doing odd jobs down at the casualty clearing station. The main job was enlarging a sort of dugout in the side of the cliff for the Company Sergeant Major. I wasn't doing any RAMC work. I was just an extra hand to make it a bit better, better arrangements for the Company Sergeant Major's dugout, which wasn't very exciting, but that's how I passed my time when I was on there.
What about the other troops you were with? You know, what was their morale like, do you think?
It was good. They weren't done to any despair. People were, over-optimistic. I remember one man saying on the ship that he'd have a report from somewhere and he's from somewhere else and so on. Where on one occasion, one of the Turks had actually bayoneted one of our men, and a medical officer came along, had picked up the Turk and dropped him in the sea. Well, all that was sheer a speculation on the one hand, or a bunkum, anyway. And it was all light-hearted and so on. Nobody seemed to show any sign of a despair or wish to get away from it and so on. It's all too fresh and novel for us.
And how about the view of the Turk? What did you all think of the Turk as a soldier then, in the early days? How did you view the Turks?
Well, of course, I didn't come in contact with them, so I can't say much there, but in general it was friendly. I know in cases where Turks were captured, they were quite pleased to be captured and be looked after and get proper food and so on, better than they got in their own lines. So I don't think there's any real trouble. On occasions, I can imagine that if somebody caught a sniper who'd been shooting at own people, he himself would be shot too. But in general, though, there wasn't any awkward stuff like that. He's known as Johnny Turk, in a friendly way.
Were they respected as fighters, as soldiers, the Turks?
I think so.
Were you aware of any German presence on the peninsula?
No. No, certainly not then or there. Germans are mainly in the background, further back, more in the background, ready to defend Constantinople as it was then, and so on.
So after your brief stay on Gallipoli, you went back to Lemnos, did you?
Yes, I joined the unit there, yes.
Yes. And what happened to you then?
Well, there I found the place was isolated for enteric. I think all the patients had enteric. Some
what
of them
is that?
Died. One or two died while I was there, I remember. But again, I didn't mind. It was all part of the show.
What actually is enteric?
He's got another name, which I can't think of now. Common name which is used in this country, but out there and in the army is called enteric.
What type of disease was it?
Abdominal.
And there was nothing to do to treat these people?
No. Now, I remember medical officers examining people, looking at the abdomen, and if you saw red spots, you put a pencil ring around them, and then look next day, and if there were more, you knew that it wasn't good. And in general, in fact, one of the people who'd been there before, one of the regular RMC who knew all about it and so on, said, "Ah, after that now, he'll be dead in 6 hours," and so on, and he was. I remember that. It didn't upset me, although I shouldn't like it now, but being pitched into it at that age, I didn't seem to mind.
And did you have the job of looking after these people?
Yes.
You couldn't be given injections or anything against catching it?
No, nothing like that. It's only very, very elementary. Feeding them, and I'm not sure if we took temperatures there. I don't think we did. It's very, very crude.
Were you all the time increasing your medical skills, do you think? Were you progressing?
I suppose I was, to some extent, yes.
And what sort of jobs were you doing, apart from looking after these patients with the enteric?
As far as I remember, it was only that. As we were isolated for enteric, and the only other recollections are that we lived in tents. The flies were pretty awful all around the tent pole at night and so on. And the meals were mainly tins of bully at the rate of one tin per man per day. Well, it was far more than we could eat. And so what we did was to build a barricade in front of each tent. And then after some weeks, we went along back to a meal. And they were all being cleared away. The quartermaster sent around to collect them. And then they reissued the next day for further meals. I remember that quite well. It's very rare if we got a meal other than plum and apple, army biscuits, and bully beef. And tea. A tea made in a Dixie, which had been used. If there were any the bully beef stew and so on, tea was made in that, and that wasn't very good.
Were you able to keep your bully beef hard in the heat of the sun? You know, did you find it melted ever?
As far as I remember, it was all right. I don't remember it being melted, but I say frequently we just didn't eat it. The weather was hot, we stuck to the plum and apple, mainly plum and apple. I think on one or two occasions we got apricot for change, and that was a treat until in turn then we got tired of that.
Was that a sort of jam, or was it stewed?
It was called jam.
Yes.
But it was.
Wasn't Tickler's jam, was it?
I'm not sure. I think it was. But it was all sorts of things. It was called plum and apple, but beside that it got all other, various other vegetables. I imagine swedes and turnips and that sort of stuff. It wasn't real jam.
Did you have bread?
Very rarely.
How about your water? You did mention earlier that there was a water problem on Lemnos.
Yes. First of all, the water problem on the peninsula was that although later on we had wells there, the majority of the water was brought up from Alexandria by ships or boats of some sort, water carriers made of skins and so on. Bring in the water. That wasn't really fresh, of course, but that's all they could get then. But on Lemnos, we had a small well not far away, but there's only one well in the region I remember, and there we could go down and collect water and find a whole lot of troops, even a battalion, all there, waiting in line, had to fill up their water bottles from this well. So obviously it took a long time. And later, the other wells were found, but I only remember this one, which was near our hospital.
Were there many other Italians there, or other nationalities?
I remember seeing some of the Zion Mule Corps. Now, Zion Mule Corps were people largely Armenians and Jews and various people who were against the Turks. They couldn't actually fight them, and they came on our side. to do odd jobs, and they formed into the Zion Mule Corps. They had mules, as a rule, and trucks of sorts to carry water from the beaches up to the regimental place. And in general, they had to go up at night when it was dark, of course, and in the daytime, I don't know what they did, but they were only obvious at night. I saw some of them about. I did see some French, Senegalese, I think it was, the people with the scarlet trousers. I remember that was very prominent.
And what were the Italians doing? You mentioned the Italians filling up their water bottles.
I don't remember Italians. I think I must have made a mistake there, then. No, I can't remember Italians there, although I did meet some in the Salonika campaign. I don't think really Italians in the Gallipoli campaign. I made a mistake.
How long were you on Lemnos, do you think?
A few weeks or a month or two, I think. I'm not sure. And then I went off by ship. I think we went to Imbros, and there we picked up wounded from the Suvla Bay landings in August. So we took them down to Alexandria again. And at one stage, took them down to Alexandria.
Did you witness any of the happenings on Suvla Bay?
No. No, I was on board all the time.
Were there many wounded from that area?
Yes, quite a lot came in. As a matter of fact, one of the main decks was converted to the hospital. It was done in a better way than it had been for the first landing, because there were proper wooden bunks to take people rather on the lines of single beds. I remember I was there as a patient. There wasn't room for me in one of the real beds, and I simply slept on a bench or something like that in one of the alleyways. And then one day there was a burial at sea, and a man was carried out and buried overboard. And then after that, I got his bed. And all I remember of that was, the next bed to me, an Australian. I thought he looked in a very bad way. And in the morning I woke up and he was gone. He'd been taken away in the night. I'd simply slept through it. I can sleep through anything. And I wasn't worried, but I'd got the bed of a man who died, and then there's another vacancy next door to me next day.
How was the morale at the time of Suvla Bay, later on in the campaign? Was it still quite high, would you say?
Well, no, I can't say as to the Suvla Bay campaign, because I knew very little about it until after the war when I got back home. I just saw the landings. I knew something of the landings on the 25th of April, but after that I had no idea of the fact that it had been a complete mess up, because even though the troops had been landed, had been ordered to push forward. Had they gone forward, they should have done, they could have finished the war off. But General Stopford, who was in charge, was quite useless. His idea was just to sit down and wait for the guns to come. Well, there's nothing to fire at. There's no point in having guns. The enemy simply scattered all about, and the guns are no good at all. It's just an infantry advance that was needed. And when they did get moving, then the Turks had advanced first, and the Turks got a good many miles, whereas we hadn't got a few hundred yards. And so that was a mess up. And there was a poor opinion then. Also, the troops who landed at Suvla hadn't been given any idea as to what it was all about. They hadn't any real maps or any sort of drive, and they were rather messed about. They could start off from one place, marching to some hill. I got there, I didn't know where to go, marched back to another place, and generally messed about. And I think it can be said that it is a bad spirit there, because they messed about. But that's only second hand. I can't say first hand on that.
You weren't aware of that at the time?
No, I knew nothing of it at the time.
No. The people you picked up, the wounded who came back, did they have anything to tell you?
Well, in general, they're so badly wounded they couldn't swim. They were all very seriously wounded cases.
How difficult was it to get them on board a ship when they were coming back, I suppose, in smaller boats, were they, to the big ship? How difficult was it to actually handle them and get them aboard without causing a great deal of pain and discomfort?
Now, I can't remember. It must have been difficult, especially when they had to be carried up companion ladders. But in some cases, there'd be a port fairly low down, just above the waterline, which would have to be closed when the ship was at sea, but which could be opened and people could be taken in almost at sea level. But I don't know if that's the case in all cases. I can't remember that.
When you look back, you know, at your role as an RAMC on one of these boats, at the particular time you were there, do you think the organisation was as good as it could have been for handling the wounded, for taking care of them?
It is not as good as it could have been, but on the other hand, there's no idea as what a casualties might be. We could have landed fairly easily, say, if it had been held up in some cases, and all the wounded wouldn't have been present.
But given that you had the amount of wounded, do you think it was quite efficient, the organisation, for taking care of them?
Well, had more casualties been expected, there should have been better facilities, I agree there. But it could have been, at Heavy Beach, for example, we were mainly held up by a small machine gun post. Well, that was unexpected. And a man with a machine gun can hold up far more than a whole lot of men with rifles. And that kept our people down practically the rest of the first day, the 25th of April. And then on the following day, they could land and get on.
How about the situation on the other beaches? Did you have any idea if the troops there were faring as badly?
No, I had no idea. Somebody wrote sometime later that had we had proper communications, radio and so on, it made all the difference. Well, there's a lot in that. On the other hand, though, if we'd had proper communications, the Turks probably would have had two, and they'd have cancelled out. But had we known what was had the GOC known what was going on simultaneously, then it would have been a lot better.
But at the time, you had no knowledge of the other beaches, such as Y Beach.
No.
You didn't hear what was going on?
No.
So how long were you in Gallipoli altogether, Major Banner?
In the campaign? Well, I landed in Alexandria, first of all, on the last day of March, and I left in October. From there, I'd got a dysentery by then, and I went to Malta. I was in hospital there for a week or so, and then brought back in by ship the Oxfordshire, which is, I think it was acting as a hospital ship, but now it's just a liner, or was a liner normally. I came back by that in October. That's all I saw of it.
Did it make a very big impression on you, participating in the Gallipoli campaign?
Yes, I think so, because it's all so novel. I'd not expected. Well, I went out there as an adventure, and I saw it, and I didn't worry about anything. It was just a part of life, and it changed from being the scouts, say.
When you left, did you really think that it could succeed? Were you sort of still very optimistic?
Yes, there didn't seem to be any reason why it shouldn't. Only, one way it was messed about from the start was, in general, when troops go overseas like that, they have an extra 10% first-line reinforcements. Well, for some reason, 29th Division did not have that. And that, again, was a point where we lost. Had we had that extra 10%, it could have made a lot of difference at the start. As it was, after landing on the 25th and the 26th, no reinforcements until a week or so later, when the 42nd Division landed to reinforce them. Also, when we were there at Cape Helles, we knew nothing of what was going on with the Anzacs or the Australians at Anzac. So that was completely unknown to us. We didn't know anything about that.
You knew there were Australians there, did you, and New Zealanders?
Yes, we had met them in Alexandria, I remember. I remember there was a bit of discord there because we were... the 29th Division was the last of the regular divisions. We were disciplined and we knew what was what. The Australians now were quite different. They'd come from the outback and sheep farms all over the place and so on, hadn't got any discipline as well. They wouldn't say sir to an officer and so on. And there was some friction because they were getting 6 shillings a day, whereas we were getting one. And so we called them the 6 bob a day tourists, and that was a little bit of an upset between the two. Although we didn't often meet them, but occasionally we did. And that, apart from that, it was all right. There's no real friction, excepting that we felt annoyed that they were getting 6 bob a day what we were getting 1 bob a day for.
Did you meet the New Zealanders?
Yes, mixed with the Australians. There were about four times as many Australians as New Zealanders, I think, roughly. But they seemed to be much of a muchness. Since then, from what I know, the New Zealanders are more like ourselves than the Australians are. The Australians are definitely different.
You mentioned that you caught dysentery and you came home because of this. Were you very ill?
Not as ill as a good many, but it was enough to put me out of action. And at Malta, I was in hospital there. I was occupying a bed which could better be occupied by a wounded man. And so I was cleared out with a batch of people coming back in the ship Oxfordshire. And that was the end of my Gallipoli expedition.
By the time you returned, later in the year 1915, were there any other diseases becoming prevalent from the campaign? You mentioned in the beginning it was mainly wounded that were being cared for, but were you finding there were more cases of dysentery and other things?
Dysentery was very prevalent. I can't remember any other widespread disease. And in the case of enteric fever, that was largely caught by men who had not been inoculated against it. Most men had it. As far as I knew, it was compulsory to be inoculated against it. But I imagine some people did get through. And those people who died were mainly, I said, those people who had not been inoculated.
I wonder if you'd tell me about the forming of the Gallipoli Association, the story of that. What made you think of founding such an association?
Sometime, I think, in the 1930s, I found there was a 29th Division Association, and I joined it. I would have joined earlier had I known, but I only knew about it then. I was very keen. I went to the reunions every year, including the cenotaph ceremony. And then in 1965, that was 50 years after the first landings, after the commencement of the campaign, it was closed down on account of age and so on. Now, I was one of the youngest, of course, and I thought it was a pity to close down as early as that, and I tried a number of senior officers suggesting something could be carried on from that, but even though people agreed, they themselves were too old to take it on. And so, to some extent, I'll say I was a fool on the grounds that fools rush in where angels fear to tread. I decided I'd do something about it for myself. And the first thing I did was to get a meeting, or to try to get a meeting of as many people I knew who'd been in the show. And so I threw a letter in the Telegraph and various private letters and so on. I got it put about. I was going to run a lunch and a dinner on the same day, the 25th of April, that was 1969. The idea was really to explore things and probably wind up they'd probably say, well, nice to have met you, and that'd be all. Instead of that, it went all very well. Quite a number of people turned up for the lunch and for the dinner. The lunch, by the way, was held at the Duke of York's headquarters, and I thought to make it more encouraging, so I'd like to get some military music. I asked in the barracks if perhaps there might be a bugler who could sound some things and so on. Instead of that, the director of music of the Coldstream Guards, who had their depot in the Duke of York's headquarters, provided a 6-man band in scarlet to come to our inaugural lunch. They played for us, and that was marvellous. Instead of paying thousands of pounds, as people would, to get there, we'd got them all for the cost of paying for their drinks, which I did with pleasure. And well, that helped matters along, and we had a meeting at the end of the lunch, and instead of closing down, everybody wanted something to start. Well, it was up to me. I'd got to do something. I asked if anybody else was keen on joining a committee, or was, if somebody put that forward as to a committee. Even though three or four people did form the committee, they all said they'd got various other commitments. They wouldn't be able to do much, even though it'd be nice to be on a committee. So it was up to me again to carry on. Well, from that, the dinner took place the same day. That reinforced the lunch. And I put in the circular that I proposed to ask that the senior officer present at the lunch to be the president at the dinner. That was the Brigadier Rackham. So he became, he presided at the dinner, and when we formed this association that day, he more or less automatically became the first president. Now, shortly after we had a committee meeting, various people turned up and decided what we could do. One man said he'd be the treasurer, because I'd say that although I'd do what I could, I'd do quite a lot on the running of it, I wasn't going to be treasurer. Somebody else should handle the money. And he volunteered to be treasurer. He was an Anzac, by the way. Andy Kirk. He'd served the Australian forces out there, and he took on the money side, which was all right. And I became, at somebody's suggestion, I became the chairman and the honorary secretary. And that meant it is up to me, and it has been all along. I really run the show, even though I have a committee and a president and so on. It's really up to me for all the, whatever goes on.
Do you have a good membership?
The membership grew for years until about the a few years, to about the early 1970s, and then it began to go down. And now, although we at the maximum, I think our number is probably about 700 veterans have joined, it's now only about, I think, about 150. I don't know the exact number, because of our age, some people are forgetful, and they don't send in their subscription money, and we don't know if they're alive or what's happened to them. And so that... It's only roughly, I can say, that the numbers are about 150 actual veteran members.